You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A grand jury in New York voted yesterday to indict former President Donald Trump on criminal charges, the first time a former U.S. president has been charged with a crime. There's a lot we don't know at this point. Specific charges, for example, aren't currently public. They're expected to be unsealed in the coming days. But the case relates to the cover-up of a payment that Trump attorney Michael Cohen made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels in the days before the 2016 election to keep quiet about an alleged sexual encounter with Trump. The charges are separate from other investigations involving the former president, including probes into his role in the January 6th insurrection and his handling of classified documents. We're taking a closer look at the story and what to expect from a grand jury indictment like this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the indictment of former President Trump? What it means to indict a former president? Are you worried about the precedent it sets? What is your reaction? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science at UW-Madison and an affiliate professor at the law school. He's an expert on constitutional law. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
A lot of emotions, I think, across the political spectrum, Howard. I want to dig into something on the procedural side of things, though. The use of a grand jury. When does a prosecutor say, you know, I'm not going to go for an indictment of my own. I'm going to convene this grand jury to review the case.
The rules are different in different states. There's always some initial proceeding in which the prosecutor, before we get to trial, you know, before anything else, has to come to a court and show I have enough to say that there's a plausible possibility of a crime here, a reason to go forward at all. In a lot of states, that's an arraignment. In the federal system, it's a grand jury. In New York, it's a grand jury. So, I mean, that's just an idiosyncrasy mm-hmm. of different practices. Historically, the idea was the grand jury would be a check on prosecutors. You had to bring in members of the community and persuade them you were not politically persecuting someone or pursuing a personal vendetta or following a charge with no reason. In fact, in practice, it doesn't really work that much as a check because in the grand jury proceeding, only the prosecutor gets to talk. There are no defense witnesses. There's no defense lawyer. There's no cross-examination. This is not a determination of guilt or innocence. This is only a threshold determination of, is there anything here at all to go forward to a criminal charge? And the most famous description is any competent prosecutor should be able to get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Right. An indictment is not a conviction. What do you watch for now with the next steps after this news of the indictment came out?
So the indictment means that the grand jury concluded, yes, Mr. Prosecutor, there's something here. You have reason to go forward and file some charges. What we don't know is what those charges are. I saw something today that said there are 34 of them, which is a remarkably large number. On the other hand, the number of charges all depends on how the prosecutor chooses to frame them. For example, supposing the crime involves false statements. Well, if you charge each false statement as a separate indictment or separate clause of the indictment, you know, those numbers can get large very quickly. Until we know what the charges actually are, we're dealing with a lot of guesswork. And a lot of speculation based on some background knowledge, of course.
Now, this is a prosecution of a former president. And there are two principles I've heard from people. Everybody's equal under the law. Being a former president and running for office again shouldn't exempt you from being prosecuted. On the other hand, there's a principle that we shouldn't use the courts to target people based on their political background. So maybe we should have a higher bar for someone in that situation to avoid the reality or perception that we're targeting someone for political reasons. How do we balance those?
Sure. On a case-by-case basis, those are both valid principles. Those are both absolutely valid principles. I'll make an analogy if I can. In a baseball game, over the course of the game, the umpire calls a certain kind of strike zone, and the players get used to a certain kind of strike zone. If in the last inning he suddenly starts calling a very different strike zone, it's still the case he's applying the rules, but he might be violating a norm of the sport. And you'll have vivid, you know, enthusiastic debates among sports fans. The recent Super Bowl had a holding call that was one of these situations about which is more important. Applying the rule in a particular case or being consistent with the norms of practice over a period of time. It's not clear in this case. you know, which of those pieces applies more than the other. It's worth noting that Michael Cohen, who's involved, of course, in the payoff process, has spent time in prison for this illegal payment. So there's something slightly ironic about saying President Trump cannot be indicted for an action that his subordinates have already spent time in prison for. On the other hand, you can, as you suggested, argue that a great deal of deference is owed. And very much, and the benefit of doubt also ought always to be given. In a situation where there is the, not just potential, but certainty that people will complain this is political, and this may raise more distrust in the system and more anger among the population.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at UW-Madison, affiliate professor at the law school, looking at the New York grand jury decision to issue indictments for former President Trump. This in the case related to money paid to Stormy Daniels to, in effect, according to the charges against Michael Cohen, by her silence in the run-up to Election Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Crash is with us in Milwaukee. Crash, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm just not concerned about this being a precedent. In fact, I welcome the precedent of a former United States president, if there's wrongdoing, being prosecuted. I think it's very democratic and very American.
Crash, thanks for the call and for illustrating a challenge of my job where I have to say precedent and president again and again. But Howard, to Crash's point, he's okay with this precedent of issuing charges against a former president.
I think Crash's point is an excellent one, and he has a really very well-informed take. And what I mean by that is, we were just saying, you know, is it a problem that this is contrary to some past tradition of deference? Well, of course, to answer that question, you have to ask, do you approve of that? Is it a good tradition? A huge set of questions were asked, for example, after the actions of the Bush administration after 9/11 and Americans' involvement in torture, should there be charges brought against government officials? And we had these same kind of debates. No, it's a bad precedent, but yes, we must enforce the law. But one thing that can certainly be argued is until there start being legal consequences for criminal activity by high officials, they will feel immune to engage in that activity. And that's a pattern we do see around the world, not just in the United States. And so I think, you know, people of intelligence and goodwill can disagree with Crash's point, but I think he makes an excellent one. I do have to correct the historical record just slightly. This is not the first president to be arrested. Sitting President Ulysses S. Grant was arrested for speeding in Washington, D.C. He was driving his carriage with two high-stepping horses too fast. A police officer named William H. West, who was a Black Civil War veteran, reluctantly but dutifully arrested him and issued a $20 fine, which Grant did not show up in court to contest.
Was he indicted at any point, though? I guess
it wasn't an indictment system. It was merely a traffic ticket.
Okay, so I'll be careful to say first indicted, not first arrested. Thank you.
And first ex-president, not right, because Grant was sitting president. So Correct. You're fine.
Crash, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, this stuff has been going on now for years, this Trump derangement syndrome, where they just want to get Trump. And Trump is going to go away. Are they going to move? Are the Democrats going to move on to just another Republican and have DeSantis derangement syndrome like they had Walker derangement syndrome? Where is this going to end?
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And Howard, to Steve's point, especially when it comes to court cases, the perception from Steve, and not just Steve, that some prosecutors around the country are looking for something to indict former President Trump for.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the phrase Trump derangement syndrome, and by the way, before that, there was Obama derangement syndrome. I think that's the earliest use of that particular phrase I've heard, but I'm sure there are others. The idea that where there is a certain president in power, his political opponents will find any reason and any measure and believe any theory to try and discredit him. It's certainly a fair concern. Obviously, the counter argument is, what if crimes have actually been committed? And, you know, when we see the charges unveiled, we'll know a little bit more. There does seem to be substantial evidence to support the argument that crimes have been committed, both in this case and in other prosecutions against Donald Trump. And if that's true, you know, one could conceivably be confronted by a situation in which there is simultaneously a derangement syndrome causing people to pursue crimes and actual crimes to be committed. just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you don't have real enemies. Well, this is a sort of the reverse of that. So we'll sort of have to wait and see. I can think of some Democratic officials who have displayed what Steve is calling Trump derangement syndrome. I don't think any of the three current ongoing investigations, which are likely to lead to indictments, can be dismissed quite that easily.
Steve, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison, political scientist, constitutional law expert, looking at the news of former President Trump being indicted by a grand jury yesterday. What we know, what we don't know, and what to expect in the days to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have about what's normal in the process of an indictment, how it might be a little less normal given the person involved and his position? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at UW-Madison, constitutional law expert, looking at the indictment of former President Trump in connection with the cover-up of a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels in the days leading up to the 2016 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Howard, before we go back to our callers, I want you to put on your political scientist hat here. A lot of people looking at the political fallout from all of this in the 2024 elections. I want to shorten the time horizon. We have this election coming up here on Tuesday for state Supreme Court, nonpartisan, technically clear partisan favorites. Do you think there's any way this indictment stirs up, has an impact on voting turnout or behavior for that election?
For the judicial election, I doubt it. There's so much at stake in this judicial election on both sides. I know this is a different topic, but you know, reflect for a moment that if you are a pro-life Wisconsin voter, you spent your whole life waiting for this opportunity. If you're a pro-choice Wisconsin voter, you spent your whole adult life, or possibly your whole life, you know, not having to be concerned about this kind of possible outcome. Suddenly, those things are on the table. I think there's so much at stake in this Wisconsin judicial election just for Wisconsin, the national electoral politics is kind of secondary.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Ellsworth. Jim, hi.
Hi. I guess my concern is if they do not hold officials like the president accountable, that sets a horrible precedent, and it's dangerous for our democracy. I mean, you go back to, Richard Nixon and saying whatever he did when he was president was legal because he was president, or, you know, like the unitary theory of the presidency. And Dick Cheney supported that as well. And I think, you know, he and Bush were accountable for war crimes, basically, that they were never charged for. And it goes on and on. So Nixon was pardoned, and then Reagan had Iran-Contra. And so these people don't think they're going to ever be held accountable, and I think that's really dangerous for our democracy.
Jim, thanks for the call. Howard, what do you think?
Well, it's unquestionably a valid point. The counterpoint, of course, is if legal proceedings become political weapons, that is destabilizing for democracy in a different way. In support of the caller's point, though, you know, it's worth remembering that a lot of the folks who were involved in the Watergate shenanigans later showed up in the Reagan administration. Some of them were then pardoned by George H.W. Bush, and they went on to show up in the Iraq War lead up. So, I mean, in other words, in the absence of prosecution, the same actors have a tendency to show up again and again in situations that are either scandalous or questionable or at least causes for concern. So both sides of that argument have really valid points. I think it is very fair to say that it is unwholesome and even destructive to have a norm that says high-ranking officials are immune from prosecution. It's equally fair to say, you know, if you're going to bring a prosecution against a highly public figure who's important to the national political scene, it better be for something real, and you'd better have a good case.
Thanks a lot for that call. Steve joins us now in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hi. My question has to do with any similarities or comparisons with Ken Starr chasing Hillary Clinton, and I think also Bill Clinton around for, it seems like, endless years. Is this really so unique, I guess? And I guess we might question whether one was more politically motivated than the other, or one had more of a legal basis than the other, but it doesn't seem to me that the Republicans have anything to call foul about it.
I got you, Steve. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Howard, compare and contrast for us.
Right, and before that, there was the Iran-Contra investigation by Democrats against Republicans. There's certainly a long history of using special prosecutor congressional investigations in ways that the other side always claims are politically partisan. These indictments, the one in New York and the one coming out of Georgia, are a little different in the sense that they are local or state prosecutors rather than Congress taking this action. And so I guess there's a fear that the politicization of the prosecutorial process is spreading. But I certainly think it's true that neither party and people from neither party are in a safe space to say, I'm shocked, you know, to discover there's politics going on in the investigation of presidents.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Ross joins us now in Wauwatosa. Ross, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm just wondering why would anybody constrain ourselves to norms when former President Trump violated all norms in all convention. If somebody could explain that, it'd be helpful. Thanks, Howard.
Thanks for the call, Ross. Go ahead, Howard.
Ross makes a lovely point. And it's actually not just Trump. Mitch McConnell in the Senate is another example. You know, there's a thing that political scientists refer to as constitutional hardball, which is public officials pushing their authority right to the limit through all norms, through all accepted limitations to limit what's legally allowed. And no one has done that more in recent years than Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, and some of the other leading Republicans. So sort of like the last call, you know, it's a little bit ironic or even amusing to hear Republicans now complaining that norms are being violated when for the last decade, Republican leadership has left norms trampled in the dust. The problem is that, you know, regardless of whose fault it is or who did it first or who's doing it more, it's a very unwholesome process. And it is democracy. I think there's a general agreement among people who study these questions that democracies that are not buttressed by supportive norms that sort of put a fence around the legal rules. So there are legal limits, but there are also people won't get too close to those legal limits because it would just be considered not the way we are supposed to do things. Without those sorts of norms, democracies become unstable. And there's a lot of literature on that. And so, you know, it's very easy to have to understand the sense of gotcha. You did it, now we're doing it. But it's not a healthy way to do politics.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that call. If we want to keep norms anywhere, Howard, it seems like prosecution. That would be a pretty good place to continue observing our norms.
Well, it is a good place because prosecutors have so much discretion. Our whole system is built on the idea that prosecutors, for example, don't have to bring charges if they're not going to win. So when you hear about a prosecutor with a 100% conviction record, that's not nearly as impressive as it sounds. He or she didn't have to bring any case unless they were sure they were going to win it. They get to choose what charges to file. They get to choose what kind of plea bargains to make. They have just an enormous, arguably constitutionally dubious amount of discretion as to what actually happens in criminal trials. And for people given that much discretion, it's even more important that they show some respect for norms and practices. I do not mean to suggest that Alvin Bragg is not doing that. As I said at the outset, if there are grounds for a serious criminal charge, it should be brought. And I don't think there's any basis, at least from what we've seen so far, to claim that his prosecution and Fannie Willis's prosecution in Georgia and Jack Smith's investigation in the Department of Justice, you know, are the kind of norm-busting hardball that we're concerned about. But that is certainly something to watch for.
Let's go now to Brad in West Salem. Brad, hello.
Hi. I just want to preface, I'm a constitutionalist. I don't have a party. I was listening to your program. The other earlier caller had stated about the like the imagination of Democrats that they're on this prosecution. And I just had the wonder and the thought that maybe is it that maybe the Republicans might be getting upset so much about this because, as one of our great founders said, he's doing something that they told us to do. You know, it's your job to avoid paying taxes. So I wonder if maybe the Republicans don't see quite how bad Trump is because it's something on a much less, more subtle manner. A lot of us follow every time we do our taxes, every time, you know, we have to go to the city to get licensing or something. We want to try and avoid paying as much as possible. So I just wonder if maybe that might be why some of the Trump voters are so upset about the prosecution of Donald Trump.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. Howard, I think clearly the political response thus far, people see the legal issues at stake often through a partisan lens here.
Very much so. Although I'm not sure that's what the caller was doing. There's a very big topic here about ideas of virtue and whether we think our leaders should be better than us or just like us. Trump brought the same kind of norm-busting, hardball, push-everything-to-the-wall approach that he had taken in law as a real estate developer. He brought that to politics. And, you know, that's one of the things that happened. He has been a guy willing to push the very, very boundary of breaking the law all the time, for decades. And on questions like taxes, when he very forthrightly said, of course I try not to pay taxes, that's because I'm smart. You know, that rung a bell. It is interesting to note that, at least based on early polling results, the fact of the indictment has bolstered Trump's position among Republicans. They are gathering around him, circling the wagons, if you like. Even as other, you know, interviews suggest that Republicans on the Hill, members of Congress, are much less eager about having him as their candidate. So in terms of the political effect, if anything, this is causing both sides to dig in, which I think is, frankly, pretty predictable.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and law expert at UW-Madison, with us to talk about what we do and don't know about yesterday's grand jury vote indicting President Trump on criminal charges. We'll watch to see what those charges are when they're made public in the coming days. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, there are a lot of obstacles to civic engagement and political compromise. A new report digs into those issues and more here in Wisconsin with a look at challenges and opportunities facing the state. Plus, the new ESPN book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at a grand jury's decision to approve an indictment of former President Donald Trump in the hush money case going back to 2016 and find out what could happen next. Now it's Food Friday. Today we're getting a taste of Italy by way of Wisconsin. Our next guest has a new cookbook out based on his own Italian restaurant in Madison. The book takes us all around Italy, from the plains to the mountains, the sea, the local farmer's market, and right to your pantry, all with restaurant-quality recipes you can make in your home kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite Italian meal? Is there an Italian dish you'd like to try making at home but need a little help with? Do you have Italian recipes passed down maybe from your own family? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Francesco Mangano is chef and owner of Osteria Papavero in Madison. He's one of four Wisconsin chefs nominated for a 2023 James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest. His new cookbook is called the Osteria Papavero Cookbook, Recipes from the Italian Shack and Beyond. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Well, can you take us back to your childhood in Bologna, Italy? What role did food play in your family growing up?
Well, a big role. And I learned how to probably roll pasta with a pasta machine, roll pasta dough, maybe when I was 6 or 7 years old. So the Easter and Christmas times were always the one where all the family would come together at the table, and not just at the table. It would take maybe a couple of days to get those meals ready for Christmas night and before Christmas Day and Easter, the eve of Easter and Easter Day. So definitely a long time spent cooking and then the next day eating.
Now, for your cookbook, you don't necessarily go for those long preparation meals. You say in the book you're giving us some weeknight meals. Can you tell us your approach to finding recipes that would work for, you know, getting a meal on the table in a couple hours?
Well, I mean, there were different approaches. We thought about this cookbook with Lindsay Christians, and definitely we didn't want to include recipes that would take, you know, 2 or 3 pages long and take too much time for any person that's cooking at home and wants to do something relatively quick. Also, there were other approaches, like we do a lot of salumi, cured meats at the restaurant, but that would have taken a cookbook on his own to do. So I'm sorry about that. Those are not necessarily included, except for maybe one recipe in the cookbook. And then there is also the part of where we process all that we get from vegetables to meats with a no-waste kind of mentality. And so we try to take full advantage of a fennel frond or a cauliflower stem. And for all those recipes, again, it would have probably taken an additional book. So we try to shrink the recipe volume and the amount of recipes to things that we really like, the customers kept on asking to be in a possible cookbook in the future, and now we have it. So, and things are favorites, from the butterscotch pudding to a few others, wild boar, pasta with pappardelle, those are all people's favorites.
Now, I think sometimes in the U.S., it's easy to think of Italian food as one thing, but as you write in your book, there's a lot of variety from place to place. Can you tell us, you know, in the place you grew up in the Bologna area, what are some of the dishes that were really important there that you bring to the cookbook?
Well, I mean, if that's like you just mentioned, it's essentially how we decide to kind of move with the structure of the book. So I have recipes that belong to me growing up, but since I grew up in Bologna, I spent most of my summers in Tuscany. I would pretty much go every summer to the mountains, typically Dolomites. The recipes kind of resonated with me from all those areas, plus I have some. My family comes from the southern part of Italy. So it did only make sense to do recipes from Bologna, recipes from Tuscany, recipies from the mountains. And then also recipes since, you know, I moved first in Madison when I was about 25, 26 years old and took advantage of the farmer's market right away, working in restaurants here. So the last part of sort of the fourth chapter of the cookbook would be what... how Osteria Papara has been using the farmer's market and take advantage in the recipes that we use that are typically Italian recipes.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Francesco Mangano, chef and owner of Osteria Papavero in Madison, one of four Wisconsin chefs nominated for a 2023 James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest. He has a new cookbook out named after his restaurant. We're talking about it and about cooking Italian food. You can join in with your favorites, your memories, or your questions for Francesco. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to look at one of the recipes. This is one you've shared with us. We're going to have it at WPR.org/Food Friday, a soup, carrot ginger soup. This one looks really good. Can you tell us a little bit about the recipe?
Yeah, this again is part of the recipes that we kind of developed at Harvest Restaurant when I was working there before opening, years before opening Papavero. My mentor was Jeff Ford back in the days, a chef that mentored also other chefs that are, have restaurants today in Milwaukee and Madison, for example, Justin Carlisle or the chef owner of Mint Mark here in Madison. So that was really his recipe. I learned how to make it. I learned also how not to mess it up. I used to have this problem with using that was my first job at a restaurant in Madison, and I had to use the blender to blend that soup every time it was time to warm it up, and I would just spray carrot ginger soup all over the wall. So I learned quickly how not to do that, but that was a recipe that resonated with me because it's a perfect use of something humble, but that is plentiful in the summer at the farmer's market, like carrots.
Carrots are coming. Are there, you know, we're coming up on spring produce season. What kind of things are you excited to use in your restaurant or that we can use in our home cooking?
Well, being a seasonal restaurant, we're very much looking forward to move away from the winter into the spring. And so things like asparagus or fava beans or peas or anything that is green and is going to come hopefully in a month and a half, we're ready to use. Crespellis or our stuffed crepe, savory crepe, we're probably going to move forward from what we have now in the menu, which is a ricotta and spinach filling, to most likely a ricotta and asparagus filling. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. But things like asparagus are so versatile. You can do Milanese style asparagus with fried egg and parmigiano on top. You can do asparagus soup. You can do grilled asparagus, or you can do, like I said, a stuffing for pasta or crepes. So definitely looking forward for that spring. It's almost there.
Now for pasta, you make some of your own, but in your book you talk about, you know, it's okay. We can buy pasta. That said, what do we look for to say, yeah, this is the dried pre-made pasta that's going to work best?
Well, there are a lot of great brands come out of Italy. We found actually a few that work for us. Even here in the States, we've been buying some Gramigna pasta, which is typically a curly pasta, short, typical from Bologna. There is a company here in Arkansas. I don't know if I necessarily need to say the name on the radio, but
sure,
it's in Arkansas. They're doing a great job with their pasta and their pasta extruder. Pasta is a work of labor, and it takes a long time to dry a pasta and slowly, and to use the right extruder, metal extruder. There are some companies still using gold extruders in Italy. Hmm. Those actually work the best. But you want to look for a good quality pasta. Again, if you don't buy it from this country, there's plenty of good ones coming from Italy, from Felicetti, from Verini, other more mainstream like Rusticella, Giuseppe Cocco. I mean, we just look for something that keeps the bite, doesn't dissolve in the water, doesn't overcook easily, and then just follow the package cooking time, I guess. Most of the time it works. But that's for the dry pasta. We make all our stuffed pasta at the restaurant. Daily, weekly. So that's definitely on us. It's a work that we do for the savory crepes, for example, 2 or 3 times a week. So
now for cooking pasta, you know, people say put in olive oil, don't put in olive oil, put in salt, don't put in salt, rinse, don't rinse. What is your secret for us making these pastas at home?
Well, I mean, that's the oil. There is sort of a legend, urban legend that says if you put oil in the water, the pasta won't stick. One piece to the other while it's cooking. Well, you still have to stir the pasta. You can just dump 2 pounds of pasta in a pot of boiling water and expect not to stick to one another. That will do that. So stir around every once in a while. Make sure you put salt in the water. The salt should in the water should taste almost as salty as the ocean water, you know, saltiness. Just that way you actually season the pasta. It doesn't taste bland. And then a light rinse right before putting your colander usually works, just to stop the cooking in the pasta and cool the pasta down very quickly. So those are just 2 or 3 hints that, you know, if you work in a professional kitchen, you get repeated by me over and over and over, like some of my cooks.
Now the chef Lydia Bastianich coming on this show has gotten me to sometimes to save my pasta water, right? That starchy pasta water. Do you save it? If so, what do you recommend that we do with it?
No, we don't save it. We don't have a big enough walking to be saving the liters or gallons of pasta water we cook every day. No, but that's a good hint. Adding a little pasta water to your sauce in the pan before you add your pasta actually will thicken up your sauce a little bit if it needs that that kind of viscosity for sure. There's pasta sauces that don't need that at all. If you make a good cream sauce or a good tomato sauce that's been simmering for a while, you probably don't need to thicken more than it really is.
We're talking to James Beard Award nominated chef Francesco Mangano from the restaurant Osteria Papavero in Madison. His new cookbook is the Osteria Papavero Cookbook, recipes from the Italian Shack and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about Italian food. Do you have a favorite Italian dish to make at home or order when you go to a restaurant, or maybe that you encountered on travels at some point in your life, or maybe you grew up with it? Share your favorites, or if you have a question about how to make, well, you fill in the blank, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have that carrot ginger soup from Francesco at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Francesco Mangano, chef and owner of Osteria Papavero in Madison, with us today to share his new cookbook on Food Friday. The cookbook's called the Osteria Papavero Cookbook, recipes from the Italian Shack and beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Italian food or particular types of Italian food? Share your favorites. Join in with your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, Francesco, there's a recipe that caught my eye. The title, the picture really grabbed me. Panino Pazzo, a crazy sandwich. I'm looking at the picture right now. It looks pretty wild. Tell us about this sandwich.
Yeah, no, that's actually an idea that came from a pizza place. That's my the town where I was born and raised. So technically, it's just a pizza dough. It's made sort of cooked in the wood fire oven, like a little disc of pizza dough, and then sliced in half and then stacked with all those goodies. So tuna, good Sicilian tuna, canned but good quality, and then prosciutto, hard-boiled eggs, lettuce, aioli, tomatoes if you have them in season in summer. So all those things are fantastic. It's something I would eat when I was a teenager, and it's something that I would crave. So it's definitely not your simple pizza margherita with tomato mozzarella, which is nothing wrong with that. But it's definitely something super tasty you can make with pizza dough.
And the recipe you've got in the book, we can sub in a ciabatta roll if we don't want to go through the trouble of making a pizza dough along the way.
Yeah, ciabatta roll is great because it's got a nice chew. It's got a, it's a little crispy on the outside. It's got this nice bubble of on the inside of a bread that's delicious and moist. So it's perfect if you want to get a thin ciabatta, freshly made. Like there's a couple of good bakers in town, or actually more than that. And then just make your own at home.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Melly is with us in Madison. Melly, hi.
Hi, buongiorno. I traveled in Italy quite a bit and visited an area called Rimini, which is south of Venice. And there at the restaurant, they had bottles of olive oil, some with chili peppers in it, and you're meant to pour it on top of your pizza before you eat it.
Oh, that sounds yummy.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's that could be pretty normal for that area. I grew up basically about an hour and 50 minutes driving from Rimini. I would go down there to have seafood with my friends, my teenage years, smorgasbord of seafood, grilled, fried appetizer. But that's something that they do, especially at the beginning of the meal. They give you the fresh fried or baked bread in the wood fire oven, very thin, very crisp, and then you pour olive oil on top. Yeah, I've seen that.
Melly, thanks for sharing that. Enjoy that experience. 800-642-1234. Now, you mentioned seafood, Francesco. Now, we're here in Wisconsin. What are some of your favorite ways to recreate some of those seafood recipes you had in Italy with the knowledge that, you know, we're here in the Midwest? We're not dipping it right out of the ocean here.
Well, I mean, it grew, Madison grew as a restaurant city, food city, but also the technology and the couriers and the possibility to get something shipped overnight, that wasn't necessarily the case or a possibility 20 years ago. You can do it now. You can do it. There's many companies, couriers, UPS, FedEx, whatever you want to use. On both coasts, we sometimes get seafood shipped from Hawaii within 36 hours at the door of the restaurant. So there's all sorts of things that you could do nowadays at a restaurant you probably could have done 20 years ago. And things like octopus or mollusks or things like seafood, mussels, clams, prawns, there's all things that you can get almost as fresh as caught, you know, the same day from the sea. And I've been, having grown up in Tuscany, maybe learned a lot of things about cooking techniques from my uncles down there. I'm definitely have an affection for seafood. So we try to do as much as we can with the produce that we can get in, which is, again, like I said, a lot better, a lot more pristine than what we could have gotten like many years ago.
And I see, you know, every now and then in your recipes, I ran into smoked salmon and things like that. So we can find creative ways to use fish in our Italian cooking too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and there is many ways. I'm going back to that no waste mentality that I was talking at the beginning. It doesn't just apply to meat or vegetables. You can also do with seafood. So there's things, if you have a nice fillet or a nice piece of salmon or trout that you have left over from the day before, it only takes very few minutes to brine it for a couple hours. And brine is essentially a salty water sugar solution. And then you can let it dry for a couple more hours in the smoker and smoke it. If you have a smoker in the summer, it's an ideal. If you can put a grill outside to grill, you can also have a smoker outside to smoke. So you can easily do something like that at home. Yep.
Talking to Francesco Mangano on this edition of Food Friday. He owns a restaurant in Madison. His new cookbook is the Osteria Papavero Cookbook, Recipes from the Italian Shack and Beyond. Now, you're here in Wisconsin. I understand you've embraced some local ingredients, including our mushrooms of Wisconsin. Can you talk about how you use those in your cooking?
Well, this is a combination of what we found in Wisconsin, what we forage during the year from about April to November ourselves, because I love to go in the woods myself. Different, many parks in Wisconsin where we can forage mushrooms. Some mushrooms we get from a good friend, Mike, just figure Mike the mushroom guy, somebody knows him like that, from other restaurants to order from him. He's a forager, he's very passionate about his mushrooms. He provides it with a lot of mushrooms, especially in the down season in the winter. And so some that we can get in Wisconsin, and then the idea or the recipe for the mushrooms too is also in the book, came also from a restaurant I happened to eat many times back in Tuscany about 20 years ago. A delicious mushrooms too, with some grilled bread, good Tuscan bread grilled. So you don't really invent anything as a chef. You recreate recipes or reinvent them a little bit, but it's hard to make up something original. It's somebody somewhere has already done it before you.
And one thing I love in the cookbook, you say Italian recipes are forgiving. You don't have to be like laser precise in your measurements and things like that. What makes the Italian cooking you do, you know, flexible for us home cooks?
Well, I mean, flexible is not sloppy. It's just that Italian food, in general, cooking is less precise than pastry. When you cook in pastry, it's better to stick to measurements. Otherwise, you come up with a lot of disasters, typically, even for a professional cook or baker. In cooking, you can be a little bit more flexible. Italian food has the advantage to not be relying on many ingredients in most recipes. So we're not talking about Thai food or Vietnamese or even Chinese or even Mexican, where, you know, make a mole with 30 ingredients. That doesn't happen almost anywhere in Italy or in any regions where they cook. So you can easily make a recipe with 4 or 5 ingredients, and that also means that you can also be a little bit more flexible and a little bit more rustic in your preparations.
And then I wanted to ask you, Francesco, about something you mentioned earlier that isn't in the cookbook. It might be a whole nother book, curing and smoking your own meats for use at the restaurant. Can you tell us just about some of the variety of Italian style meats you're doing there?
Yeah, we actually ended up many years ago writing that as a plan when most restaurants, or at least a few restaurants in Madison, were starting to make their own cured meats at the restaurant. So what we call salumi in Italy. The same as a plan we've wrote with the health department and many other restaurants use around Madison. I think we were some of the few or first ones to make their own cured meats in-house in a restaurant in Wisconsin. And we're talking about 15, 16 years ago when we began. Well, my favorite, it's hard to pinpoint a favorite. I love prosciutto, but sometimes it takes 2 years. You know, hanging time, you have to wait for it. Be ready. I love pancetta, maybe 5-6 months of hanging. Curing and hanging is enough to get a good pancetta. Salami is a lot more forgiving in terms of time. In a couple of months, you can get a salame. 2 to 3 months, you can get a beef bresaola, which is delicious. It's probably one of the easiest salumi to make. So it's hard to pick one. We try to also keep a nice variety for people that come to a restaurant, try our gran piatto, which is sort of a smorgasbord of cured meats.
I'll have to try that sometime. Francesco, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We've been talking to Francesco Mangano, chef and owner of Osteria Papavero in Madison. He's one of 4 Wisconsin chefs nominated for a 2023 James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest. And he was with us today to share his new cookbook called The Osteria Papavero Cookbook, Recipes from the Italian Shack and Beyond. You can find a recipe, that carrot ginger soup we talked about earlier. We'll have it up at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you could still share your favorite Italian food experiences as a cook or consumer. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, get some great book recommendations and share some of your own. Maybe look ahead to some great summer reads. Plus, take a look at the latest efforts to ban books in some schools and libraries in communities around the country. It's a big book talk that's coming up Monday morning at 8. Check it out here on the Ideas Network.